And I think one of the interesting things we're seeing is that AI is coming in and potentially allowing people to create marketing videos using AI that don't require you to actually physically shoot. And that lets you get high volume, lets you get personalization without extreme cost. So, there's two areas I think where content creation is being changed, one in terms of measurability, the other in terms of video, in terms of personalization and creating in volume.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, get ready for a great discussion. We're going to talk about some things that are, I guess you'd say, hype. Some things that you probably and more than likely haven't thought about. And we're also going to talk about leaders and laggers in regards to B2B marketing and selling, because we have Mike Maynard on the show with us today. Mike, welcome.
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, okay, so before we get in our discussion, though, if you could, please share a little bit about your background for the B2B DM gang so they can understand where we're coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually started my career as an electronics engineer, designing systems from like mixing desks for recording studios through to lasers that burnt through brick, which was very cool. Eventually moved into marketing. Kind of almost by accident, to be honest, but ended up in marketing. Was running marketing in Europe for a large semiconductor company, and then got a chance to buy an agency. So in 2001, I bought Napier, which was an interesting challenge. I mean, the one bit of free advice I give all your listeners at the start of this episode is timing is really important. Buying a tech agency about a month before the dot-com crash was not the best business move I ever made.
Well, as they say, you can't predict the market, right?
Well, I certainly couldn't.
But I do have to say, I find it quite compelling when you start talking about being an engineer, trained as an engineer, educated as an engineer. And when we stereotypically think about engineers, we sure in the heck don't think about creative marketing. How in the heck did that happen?
Well, I think that this is going to be a bit of a theme as we go through. I think there's a lot I've learned from engineering that really applies to marketing. And if we look at the amount of data that's available now, marketing is becoming almost an engineering type science. But the one thing I'd say is that marketers have this view about creativity. Actually, if you look at engineering is massively creative. You're trying to think up something new. You're using technology to create it, but you're trying to invent something people haven't created before. And that is an incredibly creative process. And I find it very, very similar to the process of, creating campaigns.
I think that's awesome that you shared that, because a lot of people won't necessarily think that link. So that association of that in that creative element is something that does present itself in both instances. We just don't necessarily think about that from an engineering world and from the stereotypical engineer personality.
Yeah, and I think engineers, because they're not outgoing like marketing people typically are, there's a perception that they're not creative, but actually they're creative in a very different way. They're very thoughtful about how they do it. They tend to work a lot individually in terms of designing their bit of the system. But I think, there's still a lot of creativity there. And, one of the things I found was I really liked that creative side. So with engineering, yes, there's a creative, coming up with this new concept, the way to do something. And there's quite a lot of engineering work, if you like, to get that into practice. So you actually produce something that someone can manufacture. And I didn't really enjoy that bit of it. I really like that creative bit. So that's one of the reasons I've ended up in marketing, is because it's a role where I can do more creative work and have to do maybe a little bit less of that kind of engineer process work.
The analytic elements of it, for me, I think that has become more front line and center in regards to those marketers that are more successful. They're using data in order to drive their decisions instead of, the sheer creative play, where we don't necessarily you know, take into consideration, you know, data, whether, you know, it's historical or test data.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you can look at good and bad on that. I mean, you know, Google famously tested, you know, thousands of shades of blue on their search results to see which ones generated the most clicks. You know, it's, there's a lot of things you can do with data that really is very, you know, engineer-like, very, very theoretical. I'm not sure that necessarily generates huge value for a lot of B2B companies. I mean, for Google, you know, 0.001% increase on clicks on ads makes a lot of difference. For most B2B companies, you know, 0.001% increase in, you know, new projects is insignificant, because a lot of B2B companies are dealing with a small number of high-value projects. So it is a different thing. But understanding the numbers and being able to dig beyond, you know, just simply looking at which is the biggest percentage, I think is really important. You know, actually, for a while, I went out and lectured at a local university, had an opportunity to do that. And my favorite lecture was the second lecture, where you start talking about careers in marketing. And, you know, my best line was, you know, I can tell you the one skill that's going to make you more employable, and I guarantee none of you are going to do it. And everyone was there going, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. And say, learn Excel. And you could see the whole room. It was just like, oh no. But actually the truth is, you know, a lot of marketing is driven through Excel, and being good at Excel is a real valuable superpower. So I think there's a lot that I learned in engineering that does apply, and particularly around, you know, being able to understand and manipulate and really get to the bottom of what the numbers mean, rather than just looking superficially at how big they are.
That's a great point. I mean, you know, we have to be able to contextualize. We have to be able to, you know, understand, you know, all these different variables and be able to, you know, connect it and understand whether or not it has impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite example is, you know, the Napier website. So we get thousands of visitors a month to our Napier website. And just looking at the numbers is completely pointless. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is we have this tool on there that helps you write goals in the SMART objective format. So specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, time bound. And that is 50% of our website traffic. So none of those people probably are ever going to be customers. They maybe are, but I'm guessing that 95% plus are actually students. So they're coming in and they're trying to write assignments, and looking at our traffic, we know that that's probably about true. So looking across, you know, all our traffic, well, 50% we can ignore straight away. But actually, even of that other 50% that is accessing the right kind of content, you know, because we do a lot of PR, I know there's a lot of journalists access our website. And actually, even if it was all potential customers, you know, we can only take on maybe a couple of clients a month. So any more than, you know, four clients visiting our website in a month, it's really not going to move the needle over the next couple of months. So I think you've got to really dig down and understand what you're trying to get from numbers, and how you can get that information, rather than taking the data that the tools provide, because quite often tools will spit out loads of data, but it's not asking the question, not answering the questions you want to ask.
Well, that's such a great point. Okay. So when you start talking about that, and even what we were referring to in regards to your journey and your path and things that have become, you know, more important, like you saying, hey, you want to be more marketable as far as your career is concerned, learn Excel. I mean, you know, everybody's looking at, you know, what are the current, you know, marketing trends? And so everybody is asking the questions in regards to the explosion of marketing and selling technologies is, you know, what are some of the current technology trends you're seeing for B2B marketers and sellers?
So I think this is really interesting. There's a lot of technology that's been out there for a while. And I think what happens is B2B tends to be quite conservative in the way it adopts tools. And sometimes it's very conservative in the way it uses tools. So one of the trends we're seeing is actually people using marketing automation systems for marketing automation. And that sounds like a really silly thing to say. But the reality is a lot of B2B businesses, they've bought their marketing automation tool in maybe the last 5 years. They've really bought into marketing automation. But actually, they've kind of used it as a glorified email distribution tool. And so they'll send out newsletters. They'll maybe identify where people, you know, people who've been to a particular area of their website, and they'll send them a one-off email. But there's very little, you know, really integrated automation. And we're actually seeing increasingly now companies thinking, well, actually, these tools are very powerful, and keep creating one-off emails is very inefficient. So they're trying to move away from these one-off campaigns, not killing them altogether, but reduce the effort on those and create these evergreen campaigns, these automated campaigns that will continue to run and can sit there and be ready for the next person to fill in a particular form. And rather than just sending the ebook that they promise and maybe one follow-up email, you know, we're seeing more and more people sending a sequence of emails out. It's not earth-shattering, but it is making a big difference to the efficiency and the effectiveness of marketing departments. So I think how people use tools is definitely one area that is changing. People are wanting to get more out of the tools rather than rushing and wanting to buy new tools.
Well, as you say that, I start, you know, again, going back and thinking about the whole strategy and data and, you know, being able to properly apply the appropriate tactics. And, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, integrated or in a, you know, tools that can be integrated versus, you know, having certain solutions be, I got your CRM, I got your marketing automation, I have, you know, your sales. I mean, you know, all of those being very different. But yet again, if you're talking about the conservatism of B2B, I have to start wondering, has the acceleration of change for B2B rapidly increased because of what happened to us in 2020? And, you know, the COVID and the shutdown and lockdown now, hey, you know, I have to do this. It's a survival issue, not a profit issue. So, you know, how has all that changed?
So that's an awesome question, Jim. And it's one of the questions actually that some of my clients really want to talk about and some kind of find difficult. And I'm going to be honest, you know, I used to be in sales. So I love sales. I think it's really important. But actually, what's happened is COVID and the pandemic has meant that B2B buyers spend a lot less time with salespeople. They spend a lot more time doing their own research. I mean, Gartner calls it self-directed research. And fundamentally, that's looking at marketing materials, whether it's your website, whether it's, you know, information in the media. A lot of that is driven by what you create for marketing. So the reality is the pandemic has massively shifted the balance towards marketing. So away from how much people should put into sales, and they should put more into marketing. And I think that has done two things. One is it's increased budgets, and that's helped some of those hard-pressed marketing departments that were under-resourced. So now they've actually got enough people to, rather than send an odd email campaign, to actually create these evergreen automations. So they've got enough resource to do a good job. And to be fair, they needed that. So that's created something really important, but it's also put a lot more pressure on marketing departments to deliver results. And I think, you know, more and more, the boards and the C-suite, they're looking down at marketing and thinking, actually, this is more important than it's ever been. We've really got to get this right.
Well, and I see we now even see a lot of different, you know, role changes or responsibility changes, or even, you know, essentially offshoots and growths of that, where people start talking about revenue marketing versus, you know, so we've now are creating, you know, more titles that are like chief revenue officer that has marketing responsibilities. We hear like the marketing title, you know, the chief marketing officer is actually declining. I mean, so you see a lot of these shifts and changes happening. Do you think that's all essentially an offshoot or growth of all of that?
I actually find it quite amusing that people kind of imply by this introduction of chief revenue officer and that kind of revenue function that previously they were doing marketing that had no impact on their business. I mean, that's crazy. Even if you look at, you know, the highest level branding or positioning campaigns, they're all ultimately designed to get the company in a position to where they can drive more revenue. So I think it's kind of crazy that people are separating revenue and marketing, because actually marketing should be all about driving revenue. I think what's happening is that the chief executives of companies, they're under more pressure to deliver results. They can't do that by, you know, pushing the sales team. Typically, you know, you shout at the sales team, you offer them bigger bonuses, you fire the VP of sales, you know, all of these kind of basic tactics to put pressure on the sales team. That doesn't work, you know, as well as it used to. I mean, it still helps. These sales guys still have an important position, but they're nowhere near as influential as they were pre-COVID, because people are spending more time doing that research on their own looking at marketing materials. So now they've got to push marketing to deliver a bigger chunk of that result. And to do that, they're actually focusing a lot on, you know, that kind of bottom of the funnel stuff, that lead gen, opportunity generation kind of activity. And that's typically where these revenue roles tend to sit, is at bottom of the funnel. I mean, I get why they do it. You know, if I was in that position, maybe I'd be looking to create those sort of roles. But in reality, you know, if you really want to be effective, and certainly if you want to be effective over the medium and long term, you've got to think holistically. You've got to think across that whole funnel. And one of the things we talk a lot to our clients about is what you need to be thinking about is how quickly you move people through that funnel. Because the issue is in B2B, you know, these decisions take a long time. So people move through the funnel very, very slowly. I mean, people, you know, literally move through some of our clients' funnels over the period of, you know, quarters or years. But if you can speed that up, you've got your salespeople talking to this prospect before anybody else. You're in the prime position then to close the deal. So I think, you know, just focusing on that bottom of the funnel with this, you know, magic will get people focused on revenue and short term. It's not the right solution. People have got to fix the whole of marketing and get the whole of marketing working more effectively.
Okay. So now, you know, I also want to look through a different lens. You know, you mentioned a statistic, you know, from Gartner and are referring to that in regards to, you know, the B2B buyer journey. But let's face it, Gartner has a very biased viewpoint on that. I mean, because their job, you know, is to help, you know, companies to become more aware. But we still know, especially when you start talking about difficult problems to solve with very complex solutions, and we start talking about who's in market. You know, for some organizations, it's as little as 1% of their actually addressable market, you know, place opportunities that are actually in market. Some I've seen as high as 7. I have not seen anything over 7 when you start talking about complex, high-ticket B2B solutions or services. So is it really, you know, when we start talking about contextualizing data and information, you know, appropriate for an organization that has a very complex solution that solves a very complex problem to be thinking that, you know, it's, you know, I'm going to actually essentially be addressing only 1% of the market, and therefore I should put a whole lot of money and effort in 1% of the market? Because for me, it's like, well, that's where your high competition area is, because they've already are aware of the problem. They are already aware of solutions. And, you know, now what? I'm not going to be the first one, you know, to be actually be part of that selling activity. I mean, what are your thoughts on that if I look at it from that lens?
I mean, I think you're really right. And that's a result of focusing on the bottom of the funnel. I mean, we have a client who sells baggage handling systems for airports. And you know, I'm not going to give away anything confidential here, because anyone who knows about the airport market is going to know this. There's maybe a couple of customers available every year. And the reason for that is really simple. If you're going to buy a baggage handling system, you need to put it somewhere. So you need to either be ripping out an old system from a terminal during a major refurbish, or building a new terminal or a new airport. And there just aren't that many of them being built at the moment. So there's very, very few people who are in market. But the reality is, for these guys, there's an awful lot of people involved in determining what's going to be bought for baggage handling systems. So there's people pre being in market, and they're the ones thinking about, you know, what are we going to do? Do we need a new terminal? If we build a new terminal, how are we going to do it? What, you know, what sort of requirements are we going to have? And with a system as complex as, you know, moving bags around an airport, with, you know, all the issues around storing bags, security, making sure the bags get to the right airport, the fact it's a very mechanical as well as technological solution, you know, the tender really matters. You've got to get to people before they write the tender, because the tender will be written around a particular solution. So you've got to think about people before they get into market. The other thing I think that B2B marketers have typically done a bad job on, and there have been exceptions, but generally speaking, B2B's done a really bad job on, is we've really done very poorly at trying to address people who influence the decision. So B2B, typically it's like, well, who uses our product? Let's talk to them. And the answer is, you know, yeah, that one person who uses the product, they're quite important. But, you know, think about, you know, again, this baggage handling systems for airports. You know, these things are hugely complex, hugely expensive. You know, it's not just the person responsible for managing the baggage. You know, the people involved in security, it's hugely important that the baggage handling systems can meet all the requirements of the security systems. So, you know, a simple example would be these systems move thousands of bags an hour, potentially. And all those bags have to be screened. Now, if they don't get screened automatically, how are you going to screen them? Well, the only way is to open the bag up. I mean, literally, it's either automatic or there's a person opening the bag. And you know, start putting 3,000 bags an hour into somebody's office to go and manually screen them, you've got a major problem. So there's huge input from, you know, people in security, you know, the senior executives. There's a big market in this particular industry around consultants who come in and talk about, you know, the best baggage handling solutions and approaches. So I think, you know, one of the things that B2B marketers have got to forget about is, well, you know, we've got a target audience of 1,000 companies, 1% of them are in market. So that's 10 people we care about. You know, that's absolutely wrong. You don't care about one person at each company. You've got to think about looking at the wider decision. Well, over in the Europe, we call it decision-making unit. I think you call it a buying committee more in the States. But you've really got to think about that and the wider buying committee, because that really matters. And one of the things we're finding more and more when we work with clients is their customers are not choosing products. Their customers typically are not saying, we need X product, we're going to look for the best product. What they're looking for is they're looking for a supplier. And there's lots of things that come with being, you know, that valued supplier. You've got to have a product that's good enough. Absolutely. You know, and it's got to be a good product. You can't sell poor products in a B2B setting. But equally, you know, customers today, they care about things like sustainability, particularly in Europe. They care about how long the relationship's going to be with the supplier. Quite often they care about the range of products because, you know, they're in this effort of not having a vast number of suppliers, but trying to make it more manageable. So more and more what we're seeing is actually, you've got to think about a lot more than just promoting your product or service. You've got to think about really selling yourself as a vendor and selling yourself as a vendor to everybody involved in the decision in your customer, not just the one end user that maybe your salesperson talks to.
You know, you bring up an interesting point that you hit on there a moment ago, is some of the localization, you know, issues associated with, you know, doing business and being a valued supplier. You have some, you know, European expectations and standards, and you have, you know, North American standards, and you have Asian standards. And so all of that also, I'm sure, also has to be taken into consideration when you start looking at the footprint of the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we obviously work in Europe. Our primary client base is probably American companies because we're in tech. So, you know, we do a lot of work on localization, and that can be really challenging. I mean, we had a client we worked with for a long while, and they made high performance storage systems. So basically, storage for supercomputers, and we were pretty successful in the UK. They were pretty successful in the US, you know, doing really well. Germany was really tough. And we actually spent some time trying to research what was going on and talk to people. And we talked to journalists. We talked to, you know, end users, potential customers. And one of the things that kept coming up was workflow. And we're like, well, what do you mean? It's a storage system, you know? And interestingly, the German culture is very much based around, you know, how people process work, and they talk about workflows. And so we looked at it, okay, do you know what? This is clearly important. So we started talking about how the system would improve existing workflows. So how you could bring it in, it would work with what you did already. It doesn't mean you have to throw away all your processes, but what it did was it just worked faster, worked more reliably, so your workflow is more efficient. Suddenly changed around. Everyone was like, this is great. You know, we understand this, and they now get why this product is so good. So it's not just language. It's not just standards. Sometimes it's culture and perception. And I think it's really hard. Getting someone local definitely helps. But actually, sometimes you've just got to do that work and just got to go and ask, you know, what are we doing wrong with the messaging? Why isn't it working? I mean, most companies are not doing the, you know, the famous, you know, complete failures where you see in consumer where, you know, a car brand means something different in a particular language. Those kind of awful problems generally don't happen. They're normally much more subtle. And if you ignore them, you won't really know that it's wrong because you'll get some success, but you'll definitely be underperforming compared to your potential.
Well, for me, that talking about full circle goes back to learn Excel and understand your data.
Data is it's a really important thing, both quantitative, the numbers, and also qualitative. So, you know, when you interview people, processing those interviews and understanding what people are saying, making sure you get the right feedback from the people doing it, it's so important.
Well, I think you hit on also another very important component talking about qualitative data. So, I mean, the quantitative is the what and the qualitative is the why.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's interesting to look at how you do this, because typically it's a kind of iterative process. So if you want to build some great research, the first thing you need to do is go out and talk to people and try and get an idea. So, you know, for example, I was talking today with about a client, you know, and they were talking about factors that make people choose suppliers of equipment to the electrical grid. You know, and clearly there's some factors that are obvious. So you're talking about thousands of volts. So safety kind of is going to be a factor. You know, you've got systems that are incredibly expensive that are going to sit outside for, you know, years. So quality, reliability is clearly a factor. You can work those things out. But then you talk to customers and you find out that actually, you know, there are things like being able to customize a product slightly to meet needs. That can be incredibly valuable. Or ease of doing business, or, you know, ability to ship products. Even these, you know, large electrical systems sometimes are needed on fairly short lead times. So you suddenly start learning from the customer. So you can then build your survey, you then get your data, and you go out and you ask, and you suddenly find that, as an example, you might find quality, and I have no idea, we haven't run this survey, this is made up, but, you know, maybe you find quality is rated really low. Then you've got to find out why that is. And go and ask people, you go, you know, surely quality matters. And we quite often find that something like quality sometimes isn't ranked very high as a factor. And when you go and ask people, the answer is, well, everybody in the sector has got decent quality. So there's very little differentiation on quality. So it's not a big factor in choosing which supplier. But you need to go ask people and find out what it is. So you tend to have this like qualitative interview, then you do the survey that brings you the data, and then you go and actually ask people why you got the answers in the first place. So it's a really interesting process.
Yeah, because all those different perspectives, things that are top of mind, current pressures, I mean, all of those factors will come into play in regards to how people respond. And then that additional detail will provide you with definitely more clarity around the topic. Okay, so all the things that we're talking about, including lagging B2B marketers and sellers, technology changes and you know, misapplications, poor applications, it starts, you know, making me think about what are some of the things that marketers and sellers should be avoiding, you know, in regards to the technologies that are currently out there.
That's a great question. I think you can answer that on two levels. The first is, I think, you know, there's a danger of marketers to chase the new shiny thing. And, you know, we see that if you look at, for example, marketing automation systems, you know, you'll actually see people that say, well, we've just seen, you know, we've got this system here, but this system over there, it's like 50% better. It's absolutely amazing. We should definitely spend a year porting all of it. And don't get me wrong, it's going to take a long time if you've got a lot of data, porting it across to a new system. It's going to cost you a lot of time and therefore a lot of opportunity. And we'll look at it and go, but that may be 50% better, but you're only using half the capabilities of your current system. So actually, wouldn't you be better investing that year using all the capabilities you've got and getting fantastic results and generating opportunities rather than, you know, this potential, you know, long-term opportunity? Because, you know, the reality is we know nobody ever uses 100% of a system. It's really hard to get there. And so chasing that shiny thing, I think, is the first mistake people make. It can be a real problem because there's always new technology. There's always good reasons to use that technology. But actually, a lot of what you've got today, if you've got it installed and it's working, quite often using it better can give you far better returns than trying to use a tool that is, you know, perhaps got more features.
Okay, then talking about using it better, right? All right. So, you know, we're sitting here and I think we were talking prior to actually starting to record where we were talking about a lot of these things that we're referring to today are an issue of survival. It's not about profitability anymore. It's about either it's innovate or die. I mean, as Peter Drucker said, you know, a couple decades ago, and that's becoming more real as each day passes. So then I started looking at applying and doing all this. So what are some of the new marketing tech, you know, tactics that you're seeing in regards to content creation and content distribution to help these organizations with, you know, brand awareness and being able to, you know, be that essentially, as you say, preferred provider or supplier?
Content creation, I think, is fascinating because a lot of it is really where it was, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. But we're starting to see it change. So increasingly, you know, we're seeing people look at different methods of distributing written content. You know, the PDF, love it to death. It's not great. You know, as a marketer, all you know is somebody downloaded a PDF. You don't know if they ever opened the file. You don't know how much they read. You've got no way of knowing what was interesting, what wasn't. So we're seeing, you know, quite a lot of interest around creating new platforms for written content. And I think that is something marketers should be looking at if they're not already. So there's lots of platforms. Folion's a very well-known platform. We work with a number of them. We're actually a partner for a company called Turtle. And they have effectively a way of distributing ebooks. It's a different format. It lets people skim through really quickly, but it gives the marketer a lot of data on what people read and what people skipped. And for me, that is incredibly valuable because, you know, the number of times you've sat there with a client and you've talked about a topic and the client said, we've got to have this in you know, in the content. It's really got to be there. It's so important. And you've looked at it and gone, yeah, sounds absolutely, yeah, totally right. You know, I can't argue with that. It absolutely makes sense. Actually, we put it into a platform where we can measure what people are reading. And you look at it and say, nobody cares. It matters for the person making the product. It doesn't matter for the person using the product. And it's not always easy to see that. So really understanding what people are consuming is, I think, very important. We're also seeing a lot of activity around video. So again, you know, video is not new. Video is definitely becoming democratized. So it's becoming more and more easy to create video. There is a bit of a challenge that the bar in terms of acceptable quality is going up. So there's an expectation of not quite studio quality, but great quality. And I think one of the interesting things we're seeing is that AI is coming in and potentially allowing people to create marketing videos using AI that don't require you to actually physically shoot. And that lets you get high volume. Lets you get personalization without extreme cost. So, you know, there's two areas, I think, where content creation is being changed. You know, one in terms of measurability, the other in terms of video, in terms of personalization and creating in volume.
Well, and as you're talking, though, I want to start going back and linking it and started thinking, you know, again, contextualizing this and looking at it in regards to B2B buyers. So what are the current changes in B2B buyers that are most important? Because even when you're talking and you start talking about reading, are people really spend the time to read a lot? You know, is that, you know, where video comes in? Is I start looking at all these things in regards to societal changes and what has influenced us in other areas, snippets, sound bites, attention spans. I mean, just the flood and red ocean of other information that exists out there. You know, how has all of this contributed to the current, you know, changes with the B2B buyers?
Yeah, I think you're right, Jim, that what people consume is changing. But equally, I think you've got to be careful that you don't look again at this new shiny thing and then ignore what's always been done. So, you know, are people moving more to video? Absolutely. Where are the areas? Well, things like how-tos. You know, if you're doing, as a B2B company, if all your how-tos are white papers and application notes, you're doing it wrong because people absolutely want the video. They want to see stuff. And in most B2B applications, video works really, really well. So, you know, in that area, categorically, the consumption habits have changed. I think if you're looking at, you know, areas like thought leadership, particularly in terms of where people think the markets are going, I think in terms of, you know, technical analysis as well, written content still rules. You know, thought leadership, when it's well written, is engaging and interesting. When it's on video, it's somebody talking to a screen. What benefit do I get from that? You know, equally, if I'm presenting lots and lots of data, presenting lots of data on video is not great. You know, presenting it on paper is good. So are people, you know, moving towards video? Yeah, in certain areas, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a lot of how-to stuff that is stuck in written format that absolutely has got to be in video. But equally, don't think because there's changes and video is growing and becoming more important that everything else just disappears, because it still stays there and it still has its uses. I mean, one of the challenges, I think, is that marketers today in the B2B sector, they've really got to think about, you know, producing content in multiple formats. And I hate the idea that, you know, old people read stuff and young people watch video, because, you know, that's not true. I'm old. I look at TikTok. I've got lots of friends my age who look at TikTok. Old people look at video, you know, young people read. But there is definitely a bit of societal change there. And I think, you know, what us oldies don't want to admit, but what is really true is that actually young people quite often are smarter when it comes to some of these new tools, you know, and it took me a long while to realize that if you want to learn how to do something, you don't search on the internet, you go to YouTube, because you get someone sharing that. And if that's around, you know, home improvements or fixing the car or whatever, 100% you go to YouTube. And I have to admit, people said to me, younger people who said to me, you know, this is the way to go. And I was really reluctant, and it took a while to change a habit. So I think there's some habits there, and there is an age difference. But, you know, as older, more experienced people, we should be learning from these younger people. It's not a young people can do this and old people have to be stuck here. It's just sometimes we're not great at listening to people with good ideas.
Well, as you say that, I start going back to what you had referred to earlier when you were in front of all those students and you said you want your career opportunities to be even greater, is that learn Excel. And they're like, oh, no, I don't want to do that. So then and as we're sitting here and we're talking about different technologies, different solutions, I'm talking about video, talking about all of these types of things, I'm like, well, what should a B2B marketer specialize in?
That's a great question. I'm going to cop out of this with probably the worst answer you're going to hear on the podcast. I think they should specialize in something. And let me explain what I mean by that. I don't think there's a magic one area that you specialize in that guarantees your success. And more importantly, I don't think you can necessarily specialize in an area and be sure that's going to serve you for your whole career. I mean, that would be naive. So I think what you need to do is pick something you want to specialize in and specialize in it, and just become one of the best people in that area. You know, if you look at me, I specialize in helping people communicate with engineers fundamentally. You know, most of our clients, they have products where one of the most important people involved in the purchasing decision is an engineer. And engineers, they have particular ways of communicating, they have particular requirements, and we're really, really good at communicating to that audience. But I don't think necessarily that means that someone specializing in, you know, writing fantastic, you know, marketing automation drip campaigns is doing the wrong thing. I mean, that's absolutely fine. Somebody specializing in B2B video content, someone specializing in, you know, anything else, just get that specialization. I mean, one of the things we talk about a lot at our agency is being T-shaped. And this is not our concept. It's a concept that's been around for a while. But the idea is you have a very shallow understanding across all of marketing, and then you have a really deep understanding in one particular area. And we're actually trying to build our team with loads of people with different T-shapes, they have different areas of expertise, so that when we have a client that wants to do something, we can bring someone in who genuinely is an expert. So I think there's huge opportunities if you have real expertise. So just specialize in something. That's my message.
Okay, so let's look at the flip side of that. I am looking at all of these things that are currently in place and still yet to come. And now we're sitting here at the recording of this particular interview where we now have a competitor to Twitter that seems going to be pretty formidable in Threads. I start saying, okay, well, what should I not specialize in? So what should B2B marketers not worry about specializing in?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it depends on what you want to achieve for your career. Because in some ways, just go specialize in anything. I think, you know, probably what you should avoid specializing in is something you don't enjoy or you don't like. You know, my view is, if you look at a career, there's always times when work is a grind. It doesn't matter what job you do. There'll be days that are a real grind, that are really hard to do. And if you're working in an area that you don't have any affinity to, that you perhaps even dislike, that's going to be super, super tough. So I think what you should probably avoid doing is specializing in something that you're not going to have, you know, a view that it's either the right thing to do, it's a good thing to do, or it's a fun thing to do. You know, if it's not one of those, you're going to find it tough. But there are people with micro specializations that I've met in marketing, you know, and they do incredibly well. You know, there are people who specialize in, you know, cross-site tracking on Google Analytics. You know, it's a pretty niche area. It's very geeky. It's very, very specific. It almost certainly isn't going to last them their entire career because something's going to change. You know, chances are Google Analytics is not going to rule forever. But they're doing incredibly well. And they're also learning a lot about other things. And as long as they get that breadth, they'll be able to take that ability to specialize and move into other areas as their career develops. So I don't think I'd pick anything, you know, not to specialize in. I've got to say the obvious cheap answer to this is print. You know, just don't do print advertising. Having said that, the print magazine industry in Germany is still alive and strong. And there's a lot of money being spent there. And there's a lot of, you know, people, and they tend to be, you know, frankly, much older. But there are a lot of people making really good money out at the moment. So, you know, even specializing in print, you know, if you're really good at it, it's probably not a bad idea at the moment.
We may even have a situation where some people are questioning their overall future in marketing when you start talking about AI, right? So they may say, well, all, you know, big hunk of the marketing world is going to be out of a job anyway because of AI. What type of truths is in that? Or is it a situation kind of like what you were talking about? I need to be flexible and maybe specialize in marketing of AI. But what should B2B sellers and marketers do with AI?
I think AI is a fascinating topic. So being an engineer, super excited about AI. I think the way things have improved, and particularly if you look at generative AI, so, you know, creation of images or text, I mean, the change has been phenomenal in the last year. However, being an engineer, I kind of understand some of the limitations. So we've had this phenomenal change, but we've gone from training AI on relatively small data sets to training AI on, you know, the internet. And if you look at, you know, the GPT model that's used in ChatGPT, it's trained on two scrapes of the internet. So two different scrapes of trying to get as much data from the internet as possible. It's trained on Wikipedia separately, and it's also trained on data sets for public domain books. That's pretty much all we've got in terms of written content. You know, it's really hard to think where we're going to get a lot more written content. So we've had this massive jump, but it doesn't mean that massive jump's going to continue. Because we've had a step change, so we've gone from one level to another in effectively no time. It's what engineers would call a step change. That doesn't mean it's exponential. People are very bad at understanding what exponential growth is. I absolutely think, you know, AI is going to improve. They're going to improve the complexity of the neural network, that's the technology that does all the processing. But again, there's diminishing returns on that. So rather than see this exponential growth, we're going to see a growth, but it will start to flatten off in things like generative AI. And the thing I love saying, and this is particularly to our new hires, and they hate me for it, but I look at them, they're all younger. And I talk to them and I say, you know, you've got a whole career ahead of you. And you've got to worry about AI. But the one consolation I can give you is that what AI is doing is trying to predict what the most likely next word is. So fundamentally, most likely means average. So AI is going to produce something that's average. So as long as you're above average, don't worry about AI. And then I'll look at them, and if there's four there, I'll go, so two of you will have a job in 10 years' time, and two of you should be worried. But, you know, I think it's funny, but you know, there are limitations to what AI can do. Having said that, AI is going to be massive, because what's going to happen is that rather than have one, you know, magic AI that is the marketer AI, you go and ask it to run a campaign, it will create it. What's going to happen is that marketers are going to have, you know, 100 different tools, and each one's going to make them better, more effective, help them analyze data, help them optimize campaigns. And so we're actually going to see, you know, a situation where marketers can do a much, much better job, because they're getting help from AI in all sorts of different places. I mean, we've already got help from AI in Google Ads, and no one freaked out when that went into Google Ads. And the world didn't stop, and people didn't stop hiring Google marketers. So I think you know, perhaps the best way to summarize this is that technology typically, when it comes and makes a change, it typically changes a process. It doesn't change an entire function. So I think what's going to happen is it's going to change a lot of processes. You know, it's going to change the process of creating content. It's going to change the process of analyzing data, without doubt. I mean, those two are easy answers where even what we see today is going to be nothing like what we're doing in 5 years' time.
As you're talking, though, you even mentioned something about those four employees coming in, and you're talking about average versus being above average. Is that if I'm putting a lot of, responsibility or expectation on AI to create a lot of the things that I would normally take a longer time to create, so it's improved my process, isn't there a risk that you're just going to be creating a whole lot of average things because you're using AI?
Absolutely. That's absolutely the problem. You're going to create something that looks exactly like everybody else's unless you involve marketers, unless you involve people in there to come up with creativity. So I think you're absolutely right. There's a huge risk in adopting AI and saying AI is going to make all the difference, but letting it assist people, that's going to be transformational. And it could mean, you know, the joke about the four people, two of you will be below average, so you've got to worry. I mean, that's my English sense of humor. You know, looking at our team, we've got people who, you know, I would say everybody is awesome, and I've got no worry that anybody's job is going to disappear due to AI. But I think what's going to happen is that people who do really well are going to be those who, you know, embrace AI and use it rather than try and fight it. So I think imagining that AI is going to kill everybody's job, that's a wrong approach, because firstly, it's factually wrong. It's not going to do that. It's going to definitely increase efficiency. It may ultimately, for certain activities, reduce the number of people employed. But it could actually mean that means there are very different jobs. I don't think necessarily it means there'll be fewer marketers. But I think what it's going to mean is the marketers who really embrace it and use it, those are the people who are going to be successful. So those men and women who've bought into AI and are like, you know, I'm going to accept that of this list of 20 things, there's 5 things I do really well. There's 15 things AI can do for me. They let AI do it. They do the focus on the 5 things they do really well. And again, it comes back to what do you focus on? Focus on anything and be really good at one thing. And if you're really, really good at one thing, you'll be better than AI, and that will protect your career.
Be better than AI. I'll tell you, it was a great conversation, and I really appreciate it. Mike Maynard, how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
So if anyone wants to get in touch with me, I think the standard answer on podcasts is contact me on LinkedIn. I'm never a big believer in that. If anybody wants to ask me anything, they can email me. They probably can work it out because they're all smart. But if they haven't, my email is mike@napierb2b.com. That's the number 2, so napierb2b.com. Or, of course, you can go to the website and there's contact details there.
Mike Maynard, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thanks very much, Jim. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.